Welcome to A Time for Change presented by Citi. I'm Anjali Kamlani along with Marquise Francis and joined today by Brian Chung. The holidays are often a time for overspending, but for many, they're just another harsh reminder of America's growing wealth gap, one that continues to widen during the pandemic. So how do we make sure everyone gets a piece of the pie? The Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland is on a mission to combat racial wealth inequity and raise awareness about economic inclusion. They're taking a page out of Lin-Manuel Miranda's book and using spoken word. Let's listen.
The Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland studies our economy. They found it can't reach full potential without racial equity. They track systemic proof that these disparities affect us all, and their program on economic inclusion shows where it's gone. Gender and race disparities hurt the economy we live in. Estimates of the labor gap could cost the economy trillions.
And joining us now to discuss that video, in addition to what else their program on economic inclusion is doing, is Cleveland Federal Reserve Director of the Program on Economic Inclusion, Dionisi Alliprantis. Dionisi, it's great to have you on the program this afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us. You know, it's pretty unusual to see the Federal Reserve using that type of format to convey any sort of communication. I don't see any sort of slam poetry coming from the Fed chairman. I'm wondering if you could just explain a little bit more about what the thinking was behind producing that video and kind of the larger goals of the program within the context of what you're trying to communicate here with the racial equity gap, a remaining issue in this year and age.
So thanks for having me on. So, you know, a lot of the thinking behind that video comes from some of our experience working with people in the field, where when we're interacting with people, a lot of the time we'll hear comments like, I wasn't aware that the Federal Reserve was interested in these issues. And so that video was an attempt to try to communicate to individuals and to the community that the Federal Reserve really sees its role as serving the public. And that means serving all citizens and trying to represent them and trying to work on their behalf.
Dionisi, Anjali here. Brian and I have chatted about this, and to your point, there's definitely been interest, not just at the Federal Reserve, but at other agencies as well, to try and bring in this wealth, to try and bridge this wealth gap. I wonder, in context of sort of the media market that you face today, do you see room for maybe more programs like this in order to reach places where traditional news doesn't?
Yes, I definitely do. And I think, you know, I think there's a lot of potential for us to move the conversation in constructive direction. So that's one of our goals with the program on economic inclusion. You know, so we're a research outfit. We're in the research department at the Cleveland Fed, but we're trying to also, you know, bring together researchers and practitioners to have conversations where we can learn from one another, where we can learn from community voices. And we think there's a lot of potential for kind of two-way conversations there and two-way learning. And so that's really one of the things we're going to be trying to do.
What are some of the statistics that the Cleveland Fed is looking at within the context of economic inclusion? Because that seems like that could cover a lot of different things when it comes to home ownership or job gains or unemployment. We know that there are those gaps. What specific areas of the economic disparity does this program and do these types of videos hope to address?
Yeah, so that's, you know, we have a mandate to think about maximum employment when we're thinking about monetary policy. We have to think about stable prices, but also maximum employment. We also have to think, because of the Community Reinvestment Act, about access to credit and access to capital. But, you know, in terms of our research, a lot of it's going to be looking at, you know, also long-term factors. In addition to kind of, for example, the latest kind of job market report, we're also going to be looking at things like, you know, the racial wealth gap or the racial earnings gap. When you look at those data over the past six decades, both of those gaps have stayed perfectly flat over the past six decades. So those are kinds of long-term issues we're going to be looking at. And I should also add that, you know, in the 4th District of the Federal Reserve in Cleveland's district, we also have some rural areas that, you know, are also facing very similar issues in terms of access to economic opportunity. So we're looking at some of those challenges as well. We're really just trying to be as thoughtful as we can and trying to really understand how people can access economic opportunity.
To kind of drill down into that a little bit further, we know that the pandemic has in many cases exacerbated some of these gaps, and you don't need to look farther than, for example, the Black or the Hispanic unemployment rate, as we were just showing in that chart, to show where that gap really is. But What can the Cleveland Fed do? You're not a fiscal agent. It's not like you have the ability to kind of engineer direct policies that can change those things. But when you do this outreach, when you engage with the communities, is it more of a fact gathering situation there? Or are you asking them also specifically, what can the Fed specifically do to help narrow those gaps?
You know, I think a little bit of all of the above. So, you know, we do have some control when we're thinking about things like access to credit. We do actually have a role to play there. But then in terms of the more fiscal issues, it's true that, you know, studying an issue and trying to actually, you know, implement a policy, those are very different things. And what we're involved in is studying these issues. But what we can do is we can bring to light what do we think and what does the research indicate are the most effective approaches to addressing some of these issues. So, you know, I can give an example from some of my own research. You know, when you're thinking about the racial wealth gap, you know, you might think that, say, for example, returns on capital are kind of one of the main drivers, inheritances, intergenerational transfers. And most of the time when people have looked at kind of the earnings gap, they've thought that the earnings gap was too small to sustain such a large racial wealth gap. And what we found is that actually the earnings gap is really the primary driver of the racial wealth gap when you think about things in a dynamic setting over time. And that really just kind of turns our attention to thinking about all of the factors that drive the racial earnings gap. And that's kind of an everything problem. But, you know, being aware of that or having a sense of that hopefully will direct attention and energy toward long-term solutions.
I wonder about that point, especially on the long-term solutions part and even tracking that, because this is not a new issue to the point of this is a systemic problem. It's been around for a while. Agencies have noted it, whether it be private banks or the Small Business Administration. We've seen this topic come up over and over again and programs or strategies laid out to help assess it, but it clearly seems to not have an impact. What can you do to really change that?
You know, I think, you know, getting to the research, I can, again, give an example from my own work, you know, looking at how Black and white households end up in such different neighborhoods. It's a known fact that even with the same incomes, Black and white households live in very different neighborhoods in terms of their socioeconomic status, things like poverty rates, educational attainment. And some of our research is actually indicating that that's also true for Black and white households with the same income and wealth. And so that points us to these broader, deeper issues about, you know, how some households might be trying to move to certain neighborhoods to avoid racial hostility and then, you know, passing up some economic opportunity. So this is really pointing to kind of longer term solutions. And I think, you know, in light of what you just said, I have to just agree that, you know, these are very long standing issues and I don't think they're going to be solved overnight. But I do think that between, you know, the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland and the Federal Reserve System with our Racism in the Economy series and some of these initiatives, I think we're trying to make it clear that we see ourselves as being in it for the long haul and that we are committed to trying to understand and improve the situation.
And Dionisio, really quickly, 30 seconds here. Is this in the Fed's mandate? Because a lot of people wondering, you know, if the Fed isn't normally doing this type of thing, it's not necessarily directly tied to the dual mandate. What is the role there?
Yeah, so I'll say first and foremost that I think it's very important that the Fed maintain its independence. But I think it's also clearly, for me, it's very much within our wheelhouse because, you know, as we're mandated to think about maximum employment when we're thinking conducting our monetary policy, all of these factors are connected to employment, access to opportunity. You know, these issues are really centrally connected. So I would say I think it's very clearly, you know, tied into our mandate from Congress.
Well, Dionisio Alaprantis, Director of the Program on Economic Inclusion for the Cleveland Fed, thanks so much for being here.
Welcome back to A Time for Change presented by Citi. $22 billion. That's how much money was spent by collectors and traders last year, this year on NFTs, which is a 220-fold increase from last year, according to data from Dapp Radar. And our next guest is looking to bring his crypto-focused investment management firm to an entirely new generation. Brandon Buchanan, founder and managing partner of Metaphor Capital, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. And let's get right into things. So you're a lawyer, you've worked on Wall Street doing M&A, and you're looking to take over the crypto space, particularly through NFTs. Tell us how you got here and what this all is about.
Sure. Marquise, and first, thanks for having me. You and Yahoo, I really appreciate being here. It's been a beautiful journey to get into the crypto space. Started my career as a securities lawyer doing white-collar criminal law and securities litigation. Knew I wanted to be in venture capital, so everything that I was doing along the way was a pivot to get to that point. In 2015, I co-founded a crypto fund that specialized in cryptocurrency mining. And in 2020, when I moved to Miami during the pandemic, you know, I was going deep into the DeFi world, but then sort of quickly pivoted into the NFTs because, you know, I'm so passionate about culture, you know, sports, technology, and NFTs seem to be a fusion of all my interests.
All of that was great until you mentioned Miami. I'm a little bit jealous being here in New York. But I want to ask a question. Over the last 24 hours, we've seen a couple big players within the tech industry actually take a jab at Web3. So we saw Jack Dorsey and Elon Musk say, quote, NFTs are a VC's plaything. I'm curious, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, listen, and a ton of respect for both of those guys. I mean, Elon Musk and Jack Dorsey, you're talking about two of the greatest entrepreneurs, you know, certainly in my lifetime, but in history. So when they talk, you kind of have to listen. I do think there's a little bit of Bitcoin maximalism in what some of Jack Dorsey is saying. I think when you're looking at Web3, when you're looking at what's happening with NFTs, I mean, this is sort of a return to the co-creators, to the collaborators, owning pieces of the internet or owning their digital content. So I understand what he's saying. You see VCs that are making a play, they're owning some of these, you know, layer one or layer two protocols. You know, they're invested in these coins directly and certainly are profiting off of them. But I think the infrastructure that's being built that's underlying this entire thing, this sort of movement from Web 2 to Web 3 where things are decentralized is going to be to the benefit of sort of the broader community.
And one of the things that jumped out at myself and a number of members on my team was the fact that Metaphor's board is made up of six men of color, which is a bit of an anomaly in this space, particularly in the investment management firms. So I'm curious, how did this partnership come to be and was this an intentional decision?
Yeah, no, I mean, listen, everybody on the team is extremely dynamic. I've known these guys for a very long time. So you know, how this kind of all came about, you know, Nabil and the Rocker Labs team from Miami, they were my first LP, my first investor when I did my first fund in 2015. So they've been early players in the crypto space from an investment side of things. And, you know, when I moved back to Miami, it was only, you know, it was only right that we partnered together. So I reached out to Nabil, I reached out to Juan, and we ended up kind of forming this partnership. So they kind of trusted me and my vision. And then I think collectively it all kind of worked together. And you know, I think you're right. I mean, it's unusual. You don't see a lot of investment funds that have, you know, an entire, you know, base that is, you know, Black, Latino, Indian, Asian. I mean, you don't, it's sort of atypical, but I mean, I think that's one of our best attributes. I do hope to add, you know, a few women to the general partnership, and I've definitely been, you know, trying to attract a few to the team. So that's kind of the next thing that we need to add. But I think diversity from an investment perspective is definitely going to add alpha and additional yield for our LPs. So really important.
They say shooters need to shoot. So I'm not sure if that was a bit of a pitch there, but women, slide into Brandon's DMs if you want to be a part of the team. So, and just speaking about the opportunity that's in crypto, the opportunity that's in NFTs, we understand that people of color have been left out from a lot of these budding industries for so long. And a recent Harris poll out of the University of Chicago actually found that Black Americans are leading the cryptocurrency revolution. 23% of African Americans own cryptocurrency compared to 11% of white Americans and 17% of Hispanics. Is this something that you're actually seeing on your day-to-day basis of what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say, I wouldn't necessarily say like on a day-to-day basis, but I would say, listen, you know, Black people in particular are very connected to culture. And, you know, when you think about the internet and you think about memes, you know, I mean, all you have to do is, you know, check the vernacular, check, you know, what's happening in culture and music. And certainly Black folks are on sort of the front foot of that. And so it doesn't surprise me to hear those kind of statistics. I think where you have this sort of gap is the financial resources to actually participate in some of these new economies that are starting. So from that sense, I think there's still a little bit disparity, right? I think some of the folks who are early in the technological world, who are early, you know, in IT and have been buying cryptos for a very long time, you know, these kind of first movers definitely have an advantage. But when you're looking at, you know, new products and new participants in the space, I certainly think African-Americans and really minorities broadly are interested in getting involved in the space. And I am seeing that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so since its inception, you mentioned NFTs are actually buying up pieces of the internet. For some people, some critics, they may say, well, the internet at one point was accessible for all. Is this NFT space dangerous at all? Are people just now buying up the internet and eventually it'll be inaccessible for all? Do you see any danger in the NFT? What are you seeing?
I just think the narrative is going to shift over time. I think NFTs are going to be ubiquitous. So everything that we're doing now, obviously we're starting with art and collectibles. Eventually it'll shift to gaming. But everything that we're doing from ticketing to events to you know, an ENS domain is an NFT itself, which is kind of like a .com. So I say that to say, you know, we won't be thinking about it just the same way that we don't think about the internet and HTTP, right? Like, it's just going to be something that we do. So this is a way that we'll transact digitally for very unique items. And so I don't think, you know, I don't think there's any danger in that. If anything, I think it's important for us to educate people on it now, because I think new industries, new jobs, new roles are going to sprout out of this. And so you want people to be able to, you know, learn what's happening now so that they can be participants in the future.
Absolutely. And last question here, 30 seconds. I know you are now the owner of one of the rarest NFTs. I know you recently just purchased one from Sotheby's. And I know coming up in Q1, you're looking to generate hundreds of million dollars in investment. So what is the future looking like for Metaphor?
Well, so for broadly speaking, Metaphor, I want to be the preeminent Web3 and NFT fund that's out. This sort of first foray that we're doing with Metaphor NFT Fund 1 is to stitch together what I was talking about earlier from Web 2 to Web 3 as we shift from a centralized internet to one that's decentralized. And so, you know, I'm looking at early NFTs, vintage NFTs dating back to 2014. So, you know, in that sense, like purchasing pieces like Kevin McCoy's Quantum, you know, purchasing Rare Pepes from 2016, and then moving forward to what you saw with the Bold Ape from 2021 Bored Ape Yacht Club, like I really want to show what was happening, you know, in the crypto sphere during that time and through NFTs. So that's what we're focused on now. But I think eventually you'll see us branch out into other sort of metaverse type things, whether that be virtual land or otherwise.
Oh, it's great to hear that 2014 is vintage. So can't wait to see it till they say about 2013. Brandon Buchanan, hang tight. I have a few more questions ahead.
Okay.
Because after the break, you're going to let us know about how to give the gift of NFTs in a smart way. Welcome back to A Time for Change presented by Citi. We're back with Brandon Buchanan, co-founder at Metaverse Capital, an investment firm employing a thesis-driven approach around the metaverse internet. We just spoke with Brandon about what Metaphors does, and now in the spirit of Christmas and the holidays, he's going to give us some tips about how to actually buy NFTs. So Brandon, we just closed out the last segment talking about the $3 million you spent on a rare NFT. So I'm not sure how many viewers can spend that much money, but I'm curious, if you had to suggest how to get into NFTs, where to purchase them, and where to start, what would you suggest to our viewers on how to start in the spirit of Christmas?
Well, listen, this is certainly a Christmas gift for everybody. I think this is a blessing for everyone. Everyone should stop what they're doing right now and create a MetaMask wallet or some sort of cryptocurrency wallet. The best way to learn to do this is to roll up your sleeves and get started. I promise it's not as difficult as it seems. So everyone will set up a wallet. They'll set up a MetaMask wallet, again, or another comparable wallet. I don't want to, you know, act like I'm, you know, giving preferential treatment or bias treatment to MetaMask, but it is a simple one. MetaMask wallet. You will transfer cryptocurrency to that wallet from whatever exchange you have, Coinbase, Gemini, or what have you. Typically, Ethereum is the currency that most folks use. And then you'll connect your MetaMask wallet to OpenSea or some other marketplace. And then from there, you know, you'll be able to peruse all the art, all the photographs, all the collectibles, and you'll be able to buy something that's within your range. And from there, And why I say it's important that you need to set up your own wallet is because the recipient that you're going to be sending the NFT to is going to need a wallet address themselves. So you'll need to be able to guide them through that process so that you can actually send it to them. And then at that point, once you have the recipient address, you can transfer and send whatever NFT that you bought for them.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of people oftentimes, you can think back to a gift maybe in the past that you've received and maybe you didn't like. Would it be possible to exchange or return an NFT if you got something you didn't want?
You could certainly send it back to the sender if you didn't want it, or you could just hide it in your wallet on OpenSea. But I think it's interesting. Like these NFTs are going to be sort of like your new social profile, right? And I think Gary Vee has mentioned this a few times. I think it's like to show your creativity, to show what artists that you're into. There's something very dynamic about that you're actually, you know, purchasing or being sent a different piece of works. And people do gift artwork. It happens through airdrops and other things. But, I guess there's a way to kind of send it back, but it's the same way that I guess you would take something back to the store. I mean, I don't know if you would do it. You would kind of just discard it or put it away, you know?
Yeah. And so I know a lot, the NFT is all about rarity, and I think that's where the money comes from. So I'm curious, are there any particular artists that you're liking in the NFT space, and how does it go from obtaining an NFT to actually profiting off of it?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many artists that I like. It's hard to really single them out. Ixchels is you know, one of my favorites. I mean, she is just a phenomenal generative artist. Similarly, Dmitry Cherniak, they all come from this sort of like art blocks community. And, you know, their works have skyrocketed, right? I mean, I think several months back, you could have, you know, bought a piece for, you know, a few thousand bucks. And now I think, you know, the floor for a Dmitry Cherniak piece is probably 30 ETH. So you're talking 120,000. But XCopy recently did a drop in connection with Async Art. And if you were part of the whitelist there, you could have bought it for a quarter of an ETH, which is about $1,000. You know, love Matt Cain. Kevin Abash, I mentioned earlier, he's sort of the OG crypto guy here. He has sort of like the first piece of NFT art. And then there are others. There's Rick McGinnadal, there's Seer Light. I mean, once you start going down the rabbit hole, it's just like, you know, traditional art, right? Like you love Damien Hirst, you love Cause or Jeff Koons or Nina Avni Chanel. I mean, there's just so many people out there doing fantastic work. And it's just really cool to see it in a sort of a digital way. But yeah, that's, I would recommend those to anyone and folks who are just starting a portfolio. You know, I would recommend kind of mirroring what we're doing at Metaphor, looking for these kind of older, early vintage pieces of NFTs. You can go buy a Mooncat, which originated in 2017 for 0.4 ETH. You know, you can buy rare Pepes for pretty cheap as well.
Absolutely. I appreciate all of that. It sounds like there's so many different options. So Brandon, thank you so much. Brandon Buchanan, co-founder, founder and managing partner of Metaphor Capital. Thank you for all of that insight. One thing I took away from what you just said, start a wallet, just get your hands dirty. So look up Marquise Francis. I might be making my NFT soon. But there's a lot of great ideas for Christmas coming up.